Welcome. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. I'm going to start with an article from AARP, the magazine, up front, What I Know Now. This is by Mary Lou Henner. On the taxi boom, slinging advice, and remembering, well, everything. Embracing your heritage. My father was Polish, my mother was Greek. Kalogeropoulos. My brother went to this tiny Greek village, Methone, walked into a restaurant and said, I'm looking for the Kalogeropoulos family. He found 31 relatives and brought back these videos of everyone sun-kissed and eating and drinking on the beach. Why did we ever leave? The heart of Chicago. Growing up, our home was the cultural center of the neighborhood. We had a dancing school in the backyard, a beauty shop in the kitchen, and art classes upstairs. My mother taught dancing. We had 200 students between the ages of 2 and 80, including the nuns who came for stretch class. Everybody had their first kiss somewhere on our property, and one of my first memories was being on stage at 2 and a half. Total recall. I have a highly superior autobiographical memory, HSAM. People with HSAM have extraordinary recall. I do something funny at my cabaret show. People tell me a date, and I tell them what day of the week it was on, what I was doing, what song was popular, and then I'll sing a couple of bars. When everything shifted, September 5th, 1978, Taxi had gone on the air 3 days earlier. I was in New Orleans for an All Sphinx fight. Ali Sphinx fight. And the guys from Taxi were there as well. After the fight, we walked down the street together, and people were honking and yelling, Hey, Louie! Hey, Nardo! Hey, Banta! We all knew our lives had changed. Let me tell you, I'm the queen of advice. My brother always says, you write books just so you can give everybody tips. I've written 10 books full of tips. I love sharing information. I think it's because I'm a middle child. Raise 'em up tough. My two boys, Nick and Joey, have never given me one day of trouble. They love each other. They work hard. I lost my parents young, so I wanted my boys to be scrappy should anything happen to me. I taught them about consequences. I even wrote a book called I Refuse to Raise a Brat. Family is family. Every group of people I've been close to, I turn into a family. I'm still close to my Greece family and my Chicago the Musical family. During the pandemic, I started Zooms with the Taxi Gang, and we're about to do our 21st. Nothing is better than friend maintenance. Food and you. After my parents died in their 50s, I read hundreds of health books and talked to doctors and nutritionists. I learned to love food that loved me. Dairy didn't love me. Meat didn't. Gluten and sugar didn't. My husband and I eat 99% plant-based. No dairy, no meat, no chicken, gluten, or refined sugar. Once in a while we have sushi. That's our not-so-guilty pleasure. And this was as told to Natasha Stoynoff. Stage and screen star Mary Lou Henner, 72, is a 5-time Golden Globe-nominated actor. For Taxi, health advocate and New York Times best-selling author. She is currently touring the country with her one-woman cabaret show, Music and Memories. Now, how about under Healthy You, 5 ways to add 5 grams of fiber. Eating more fiber has been linked to longevity and weight loss. Here's how to up your game. This is by Stephen Perrine. My grandmother called it roughage, but today we know it as fiber. That good-for-you plant stuff that helps lower cholesterol, cuts your risk of weight gain, and feeds your gut microbiomes. The U.S. dietary guidelines recommended that women and who are 50 and older eat at least 22 grams per day, and men at least 28. Some research suggests that even more is better. In one study, eating 30 grams of fiber per day was nearly as effective for weight loss as cutting out sugar, fat, salt, and alcohol. But the average American consumes a mere 18 grams per day. How can we do better? High fiber cereals and lots of beans can get you there, but maybe eating like a rabbit or a cowboy isn't for you. Here are some other ways to boost your intake. 1. Cheat your crust. A quarter cup of nearly flavorless ground flaxseed has more than 11 grams of fiber. Sprinkle it into pie crust doughs or cake batters, and pick pumpkin pie. A cup of pumpkin has 7 grams. 2. Visit the orchard. A single apple gives you 5 grams of fiber. A single pear or persimmon provides 6 grams. 3. Take a dip. Swap out your onion dip for hummus made from chickpeas. It delivers 5 grams of fiber per one-third of a cup. 4. Choose whole wheat pasta. A cup supplies nearly 6 grams, more than double that of plain pasta. Or try red lentil or chickpea pasta. And 5, see red. Half a cup of raspberries has 5 grams of fiber, more than double that of blueberries, strawberries, or blackberries. This piece was by Stephen Perrine, who's the author of several books on nutrition, including AARP's New York Times bestseller, The Whole Body Reset. Next up is, under Healthy You, Stand Up Against Sitting Disease. Physicians say it's a real phenomenon, and simply going to the gym won't fix it. Here's what you can do instead. And this is by Nicole Pager. Kelly Bloomquist, 45, spent up to 10 hours a day sitting at her desk in her home office. That, plus ending her day with family couch hangs, left the media executive with very little time on her feet. "My legs were always falling asleep. I've had to stand up just to get feeling back into my legs and butt," she recalls. During a doctor's appointment, Bloomquist learned she was pre-diabetic and had an array of autoimmune issues, largely as a result of her inactive lifestyle. So she purchased a treadmill and stand-up desk and now challenges herself to hit a daily 10,000 steps. "I've lost weight. I'm no longer pre-diabetic," she says. She also is focusing better at work. Bloomquist had what doctors refer to as sitting disease, a term for the negative effects of being too inactive, which experts warn is becoming all too common these days. It's often said that sitting is the new smoking, but in recent years, more research has shown just how unhealthy our sedentary lifestyles are. Here's what you need to know. You're probably sitting a lot more than you think. On average, U.S. adults are spending 11 to 12 hours per day sedentary, which represents three-quarters of their waking hours, says Keith Diaz, associate professor of behavioral medicine at Columbia University Medical Center in New York City. Consider our most popular leisure activity, especially among older adults, watching TV. People 65 and older watch it for an average of 6.4 hours a day, while essentially enlisting technology to be active for us. While you're watching TV, a microwave could be cooking your food. A dishwasher could be washing your dirty dishes. A laundry machine could be washing your soiled clothes. A vacuum could be self-cleaning the floor, says Diaz. And many of us who still work are doing it from home, and hence not getting up to walk over to coworkers or into meetings. Sitting is worse for you than just about any other position. Researchers broke a 24-hour day into 5 core behaviors: sleeping, sitting, standing, light activity, and moderate to vigorous activity. Moderate to vigorous exercise, running, cycling, and more was found to be best for your heart. Next came lighter activities like walking, followed by standing, then sleeping. They were all better for you than sitting, says lead researcher Joe Blodgett, a senior research fellow at University College London. Sitting diminishes your brain. People who sit for more than 10 hours a day are at greater risk of developing dementia. Prolonged sitting can also worsen symptoms of depression and anxiety. Sitting impacts your longevity. A 2016 review of 13 studies found that sitting for 8 hours a day with no activity puts you at a similar risk of dying as smoking and obesity. Too much sitting leads to an increased risk of diabetes, heart disease, blood clots, and certain cancers. Sitting damages your fitness and mobility. Anytime you spend a lot of time in one position, your muscles adapt to that position, which makes it so that you're less flexible. It's harder to get the full range of motion when you're doing an activity, says Claire Morrow, a physical therapist with Hinge Health in San Francisco. You can't fully undo the damage by exercising. The more time you spend sitting, the greater risk you have for most chronic diseases, independent of whether you exercise or not. This notion that I've exercised today, check off my box for moving and I'm done, is not enough. For ideal health, we need to move throughout our day, not just in one bout of exercise for 30 to 60 minutes. I used to tell people you need 30 to 40 minutes of exercise at one time. I was wrong, says Barry Franklin, Director of Preventative Cardiology and Cardiac Rehabilitation at Corewell Health William Beaumont University Hospital in Royal Oak, Michigan. He now tells patients that even 1 to 2 minutes of movement every hour throughout the day has a big impact. So over 16 hours, if you're doing 2 minutes every hour, you're getting more than 30 minutes, he explained. Moving every half hour for 5 minutes has substantial positive effects on blood sugar levels, Diaz says. Getting up after a meal, even for a slow walk, is enough to reduce blood sugar spikes by 60%, equivalent to the effects of medication, he says. And moving every hour for just 1 minute provides a reduction in blood pressure comparable to what you would experience from exercising daily for 3 to 6 months. In a perfect world, you would log at least 8,000 steps per day, says Edward Coyle, a professor in the Department of Kinesiology and Health Education with the University of Texas at Austin. 8,000 is the number his team found was the key to a healthy fat metabolism. But any amount helps. If you are inactive, for each 1,000 steps you take, you lower your risk of dying and having heart disease by 15%, he says. Even seconds of activity throughout the day have immense benefits. Coyle's team had people hop on an exercise bike for quick sprints and found that if they did this for 20 seconds every hour, they maintained a healthy fat metabolism. The bottom line? Now that you've finished reading this article, get up and walk around for just 2 minutes. It could add years to your life. And here we have 6 sneaky ways to move your butt. Take an exercise snack. Getting enough exercise is much more doable if you break it up into exercise snacks. Take a TV intermission and do a dozen jumping jacks. Read for an hour, then walk up and down the stairs a few times. Sit, but not still. Even moving around in your chair has benefits, says Franklin. If we fidget while sitting, move our legs while at the computer, or if we stand while on the phone, that's another source of disguised energy expenditure. Create a new habit. We brush our teeth each morning, making it a daily habit. Try the same thing with movement. Find routines in your life where you can tie in movement breaks, says Diaz. Finish a task, then take a 5-minute walk before jumping into the next thing. Activate your social life. You call up a friend to grab a cocktail, a meal, or a movie, all sedentary activities. Challenge yourself to pair socializing with moving. Invite a friend to play pickleball, help you out in the garden, or go for a walk. Make things a little harder. Make the trek to a restroom down the hall in lieu of the closest one. Take your dog for more frequent short walks, and park further away from a store than you normally would to sneak a few more steps in. And finally, go analog. Instead of texting or emailing someone nearby, get up and walk over to that person. It will help your health and your relationship. The author of this piece, Nicole Pager, writes on health and wellness for the New York Times and Woman's Daily. Now let's look at an article from AARP, the Bulletin, The Lay Person's Guide to Painkillers. Medications can be a key element in treating chronic pain, but each type delivers side effects. We use all the medications with some caution, says Johns Hopkins Medicine oncologist and palliative care physician Thomas Smith, MD. Here's what to know about your options. Acetaminophen. What it is. Tylenol, Anacin AF, Tactina, and store brands. How it's used. We often start with acetaminophen as it works in a specific part of the brain to decrease discomfort, Smith says. It can be added to other medications for more relief and to help you use less of each drug. Warnings. It is metabolized in the liver. Stick to recommended dosages, as overuse can cause liver failure. Oral steroids. What they are. Prednisone, hydrocortisone, or dexamethasone. How they're used. To decrease inflammation and pain for chronic conditions such as rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's disease, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. Warnings. Can have side effects such as swelling, high blood pressure, mood changes, and upset stomach. So they're typically used only in the short term. Anticonvulsants. What they are. Gabapentin, pregabalin. How they're used. May be prescribed to treat certain types of nerve pain. Changes nerve endings to reduce pain, but patients also often have to try two or three drugs or a combination before finding relief. Warnings, clumsiness and unsteadiness associated with overdose when combined with opioids as they cause breathing issues. Depressants, what they are. Prescription, benzodiazepines. How they're used? May be prescribed as part of a cocktail of pain relief as they can decrease muscle spasms, anxiety, and insomnia. However, these are generally not effective to treat chronic pain. Warnings. They're dangerous. A central nervous system depressant. They can suppress breathing and can be deadly when combined with an opioid. Topical. What it is, lidocaine, capsaicin, menthol patches, and creams. How it's used. Topicals work by targeting nerve receptors under the skin, helping to relieve pain. Capsaicin, the compound that gives chili peppers a kick, is effective in treating diabetic neuropathy, especially for those who have trouble tolerating oral medications. Lidocaine and menthol, the cooling sensation found in mint, help to relieve muscle and chronic back pain. Warnings. Skin reactions such as burning, redness, and itching, as well as nausea. NSAIDs. What they are. Ibuprofen, aspirin, naproxen. How they're used. Available over-the-counter or in stronger prescription formulas, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs reduce inflammation at the site of the pain. Warnings. Risks include gastrointestinal bleeding and kidney damage. Taking NSAIDs for more than 15 days in a row can trigger rebound headaches in which the painkiller itself is the cause of the pain. Antidepressants. What they are. Tricyclic antidepressants and SNRIs. How they're used. Can be effective for certain types of pain, such as nerve pain and migraine, sometimes used in combination with an anticonvulsant. Warning, may cause drowsiness and insomnia, or worse, heart problems. Research shows these can increase the risk of falls in older adults. Muscle relaxants. What they are, prescription antispastics and antispasmodics. How they're used, for short-term muscle pain. Muscle relaxants were never studied to be used long-term, but many patients are prescribed these and take them day in and day out for years, says UC San Diego pain specialist Timothy Furnish, MD. Warnings, can cause increase the risk of falls and confusion, mood swings, and thoughts of suicide. And finally, opioids, what they are. Legal prescription opioids include hydrocodone, oxymorphone, morphine, codeine, and fentanyl. How they're used? Extended-release capsules or tablets may be used to provide a baseline of pain relief alongside a short-acting opioid as needed, Smith says. Warning, highly addictive, contributing to misuse and overdose, and they're difficult to come off. Constipation is common. This article, also from the magazine under the heading of Money Saver, Stay Insured or Take the Cash? Jean Chatsky to the Rescue. A couple wonders whether they should hold on to their whole life policies. The problem is their life insurance worth keeping? Stephen and Catherine Birch, both 62, brought policies after marrying in 1984. My father always had life insurance, said Stephen, who purchased whole life policies both to protect against disaster and to build wealth. Today, Stephen's policy has a death benefit of about $200,000 and a cash value of $93,000. Catherine's is worth about $70,000, but there's a cost. The premiums, rising about 11% annually, are now more than $2,000 a year. Should we keep the policies for the death benefit, Stephen asks, or should they cash out? The advice. Permanent insurance, such as the Birches, whole life policies, have both a death benefit and an investment component or cash value designed to grow over time. If a policyholder dies, beneficiaries get the death benefit, but the holder can access the smaller cash value earlier by surrendering the policy. Advice about surrendering can be clouded by conflicts of interest. Insurance agents might favor keeping a policy. Financial advisors might prefer you to cash out so they can invest the proceeds. Indeed, Stephen's insurance agent said to keep the coverage, and his financial advisor said to cash it out. So I turned elsewhere for help. Wisconsin-based actuary Scott Witt, one of the few fee-only life insurance advisors in the U.S., rather than sell insurance, these professionals evaluate policies people are thinking of buying, cashing out, or reconfiguring. This is not a cookie-cutter analysis, Witt says. If I had two clients with the exact same policy, the advice for one might be to hang on till death and for the other to surrender. Witt's first question for Steve and Catherine, who both work at a small private school, do they need the insurance for their family? Not anymore. They're already well-situated for retirement, thanks partly to Stephen's prior career in the corporate sector. Their two sons, both in their 30s, live independently. They'll be fine without any death benefit. How is their health? Catherine's is great, and Stephen's is under control with medication. Each comes from a long-lived family. If they cashed out, how would they invest the money? Mostly in stocks. Finally, what's the potential for regret? people are reluctant to surrender because they're convinced that as soon as they do, they'll get hit by a bus, Witt says. Can the Birches let go of that thought? Yes, says Stephen. Then came Witt's analysis. If the Birches kept the policy, Witt recommended reconfiguring them to stop paying premiums. That would cut their death benefits but improve their investment performance. If they cashed out, he assumed they would put the money in stocks with an annual return, his estimate, of 7%. Witt estimated that the Birches would net around $88,000 by surrendering Stephen's policy, since nearly $40,000 of its current $93,000 cash value represents an investment gain subject to federal and state taxes. So, if Stephen got hit by the proverbial bus next year, keeping the insurance with its $200,000 death benefit would have been the better move, but his one-year mortality risk is low, about 1 in 1,000. If Stephen lives to age 76, which he's 92% likely to do, the invested cash is projected to hit around $210,000, eclipsing the death benefit, which would have grown to $207,000. The math on Catherine's policy is similar. The outcome? Stephen and Catherine plan to surrender their insurance. We had to go back to why we got it in the first place, Stephen says. Those reasons aren't true anymore. Witt concurs with that approach. Anytime you go through a significant life-altering event, he says, whether it's retiring or getting your kids off the family payroll, it's a good time to reassess your insurance needs. Want Gene Chatsky to write about helping you sort out your financial problems? Email rescue@aarp.org. Now, for the few minutes of few seconds of our remaining time, let's look at a few ways to save money in entertainment. Wait to buy your theater tickets for sporting events. For most regular season games across all major sports, prices usually drop as the event approaches. Watch for tickets leading up to the game. But not for concerts. Tickets for top musical acts almost never drop in price as the event approaches. In fact, your goal is to buy tickets the first day they go on sale and directly from the venue or its official ticket-selling agency, both to get yourself better seats and to lock in more reasonable, often band-approved costs. If you wait, you're likely to pay more to ticket sellers. Well, folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure and listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.